Well, this is, of course, Christmas season, and it's much expected and anticipated for all of us. In the Christian calendar, it's a very, very important feast. It's a very, very important commemoration, and it has deep spiritual and theological significance. What we celebrate, what we remember during the Christmas season is something called the Incarnation. That's a big theological word. Most of us have probably heard it many times, but it simply means the enfleshing, the becoming of a human being of God himself. God become man. And living a normal life, being born as a baby, we believe that Jesus Christ is unique as a human being. Not only was he prophesied, but his origin is unique. And I'll look at a couple of prophecies to show us that in just a moment. But the thing that we're celebrating is that God has become one of us. And there are many implications to that. First of all, as I mentioned earlier, God who created the universe, and we're going to look at that in more detail, God who created the universe did not remain aloof from us. He left glory to become not only one of us, but to make himself known to us. He is not hidden from us. He is drawn near to us. And for many people, I find this true for many people, they wonder, does God care about me? Does God reject me? Will God accept me? If the Incarnation tells us anything, it tells us that not only will God accept us, but he is seeking us. He is searching for us. He has, at great sacrifice and cost to himself, entered into our realm, entered into human life and the earthly realm. Not only is he not rejecting us, he is approaching us. Not only is he not hiding from us, he is seeking us. As Jesus said, the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. Not only is he not oppressing us, he is serving us. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. This is an amazing thing that God has done. It's unbelievable. It doesn't even make sense. It's lavish grace that God shows us in what we call the Incarnation. And so, yes, we celebrate the birth of a baby, but we celebrate all that it means. And we'll be having Christmas Eve, and hopefully you will be hearing carols and declaring some of the amazing events that happened around the birth of Christ. God is drawing near to us. Just remember that. Really, what I want to talk about today is that he actually dwells among us. God dwells among us. That's good news for all of us. Now, we see this prophetically. Prophecy I read a little earlier, Isaiah 7:14. This is prophesied long before Christ was born. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. One of my favorite Christmas carols, O come, O come, Emmanuel. Emmanuel is a Hebrew word. El means God. And the rest of that word means with us. God with us. God present with us. God near to us. So I just want to assure you today, God is present. God is a God who has sought to be near to us. This is really very comforting and encouraging. He's not a God far away. He is a God who is near. Then there's another prophecy that was given also by Isaiah about the same time in chapter 9, verses 6 and 7. Also talking about the Messiah, and this is what we celebrate at Christmas time. To us a child is born, to us a son is given. And it talks about his power, not only his ability to affect the world that we live in, but he's talking about a heavenly kingdom that is eternal in nature. The government shall be upon his shoulder. His name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor. And here's the one that catches my eye, Mighty God. If this is a prophecy about the Messiah, about a human being who is going to be born, who is going to come, and be part of our life. If this is a prophecy about the Messiah, and this is a Jewish understanding of the nature of the law, if this is not God-inspired, then it's blasphemy. It is blasphemy to call a human being mighty God. It's utter blasphemy. And yet that is what we are calling Jesus Christ, mighty God, the mighty God, God with us, God present with us. There's no question from the Old Testament prophecies that it is understood that the Messiah is actually God in our midst. He is called the mighty God. Any human being, anyone who is solely a human being who might be given this title, that would be blasphemous, but it is not. This is the nature of our Messiah, everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. And then it goes on to say, of the increase of his government and of peace, there'll be no end. And on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness, from this time forth and forever, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. It's a declaration that Jesus will have, the Messiah, the Son of David, will have a kingdom. And he preached much about the kingdom of heaven. And as we embrace a relationship with him, as he draws near to us, we draw near to him, we enter in to his kingdom. It's a kingdom that will endure forever and that we will participate in forever. So we have a God who is near to us. We have a God who has not remained aloof. We have a God who's not hiding. He is found. He wants to be found, and he wants to be near us. Now I want to look at another passage in John 1 that talks a little further about who it is who is dwelling with us. John 1, 1 through 14, we'll look at. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him. Without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. All life comes through this word. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Now there was a man sent from God whose name was John. He's speaking of John the Baptist. He came as a witness to bear witness about the light, that all might believe through him. He, that is John, was not the light, but he came to bear witness about the light. The true light, which gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world. The world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor the will of man, but of God. Essentially, born again, born of the Spirit. Not out of human volition, but out of God's will. And here is the line I want to think about for a moment. This word that created all things, through whom all things were created, without which nothing was made that was made, this word became flesh and dwelt among us. Emmanuel, God with us. And we've seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. Verse 15 continues, and I don't know if we have that actually pulled up, but we are told that John bore witness about him and cried out, "This is he of whom I said, he who comes after me ranks before me because he was before me. And from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, the only God, who is at the Father's side. He has made him known." So what we're being told here is that we worship a God who created all things. Now, you would think that would be an obvious thing. If we're worshiping God, obviously, he's the creator of all things. But I want you to know that there are two very strong, competing, and antagonistic worldviews at work in the world that we live in. There was a very secular, what I would call a secular worldview, a competing worldview that we would call atheistic materialism. It is very powerful, it is very widely accepted, and is very much competing with what I want to share with you today. Atheistic materialism is perhaps best summed up in a saying by the astronomer and very popular scientist who has now passed away named Carl Sagan, and he had a word that was stated as follows, a brief saying. The cosmos, that is the material, physical universe, is all that is or was or ever will be. This is religious language. It is saying that the ultimate thing that exists is the cosmos. It is the created order. It's the material universe. And you know what? This is very popular thinking, atheistic materialism. As a man named Cornelius Hunter with the Discovery Institute has commented on these thoughts. Every once in a while, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, every once in a while, an atheistic materialist distills their thoughts into pithy statements that profoundly summarize what it's all about for them. Carl Sagan's 1980 Cosmos video is chock full of such statements, but none is better than his classic opening line, "The cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be." Obviously, that is a truth claim, but it doesn't come from science. Truth claims that do not come from science are nothing new. What is new, however, is the presentation of such truth as science, and so there's nothing wrong with the claim that they believe, but there is something wrong with the insistence that everyone else must believe it as well. There is absolutely no way to verify a faith claim that the universe, the cosmos, is all there was, is, or ever will be. How do you that? You have to be really old to say, I saw it, I can confirm it, and I can repeat it by experimentation, which is by definition what science is. Amen. Right? Yeah. Right. I think I got excited about that. Not to be antagonistic personally, you don't believe me. Not to be antagonistic personally, but at odds ideologically, at odds theologically, because that is a theological statement. I don't care how you cut it, that is a theological statement. It defines what is ultimate and what is not ultimate. And there is a belief that says the ultimate thing is what you can see, touch, sense, feel, taste, discover, find through your senses. Therefore, man is the measure of all things. What I can know, discover, talk about, reveal is all there is. We believe something different. We believe that in the beginning, there was no universe. There was the Word. The Word is pre-existent. And without this Word, there was not anything made that was made. That is an article of faith for us. This is the Christian doctrine of creation. That God precedes the creation, that He dwells in eternity, and eternity is not a long time. Eternity precedes time. Time, eternity has nothing to do with time, because it is God speaking out of eternity. That is how time was created. God, eternity, it's a state of being that God Himself dwells in. And this God created all things. We see this in Genesis chapter 1, 1 and 2. It's the same idea being expressed. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the deep. The Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And then you read the account. God began to speak things into existence. And there's a lot of mystery here. And I don't draw a lot of conclusions about how all of this came into being. I just know what the word is telling us is that God, ex nihilo, out of nothing, made everything that is. And he is the responsible party who brings into being the incredible beauty, the incredible variety, the incredible power of everything that we see. It all screams, I exist, I am powerful, I am eternal. There's no one like me, no one like me. And who has given to mankind the ability to discover some little portion of his secrets. It's what he has done for us. Now, the Christian creeds put it this way. One of our greatest creed that the church has composed over the years. I believe in one God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, of all things visible and invisible. What's this invisible stuff? There's a world that is not visible, that is not touched by the senses. It can make itself known to the senses. It's called revelation. It can unveil itself to our senses, but it is not necessarily or freely accessible to the senses simply by an act of our own will. It must be willed by God that it be revealed. It must be bestowed by God by his will. And that is why it says, not of the will of man, not of the will of flesh, but by the will of God, Christ becomes one with us. By the will of God, Christ, God, became incarnate in Jesus Christ. This is the most amazing message that he's given to the earth. I'm here, Emmanuel. Yes, the one who did all of this is here. I am with you. I am with you. We perceive that by things invisible. Perceive that by the Spirit. You can't do an experiment and repeat that. That's something God gives by his grace. Something he gives by the gift of special revelation. Revelation is also a doctrine. The entire universe is a general revelation. Good for those who say that the universe is spectacular and amazing. In fact, even in this Cosmos video series that we mentioned, there's an acknowledgement of mystery. There's an acknowledgement of awe because we are made to be in awe. We are made to worship. But here's the problem. It is part of our fallen nature that we worship the creator, the creature. We worship what is created rather than the creator. All awe is designed to move us to worship the creator. That's our purpose. We're designed for that. But we stumble. We fall short. We sin by becoming enthralled with the created order and saying somehow, oh, that's God. That is not God. That is a revelation of the power of God. It is God's handiwork. The heavens are telling the glory of God. The earth declares his handiwork. Day to day pours forth speech. There's no sound or words. But there's a revelation. God has done all these things. And we have to choose not to believe that because it's so ingrained in our spirit. We're made in the image of God. We know it's true. And because we're made in the image of God, we're able to explore these things and discover them. But because we are also sinful and fallen, we come to very, very unfortunate and erroneous conclusions about what it is that we're seeing and what it is that we're exploring and what it is that we're discovering, and we are saying, oh, that's all there is, all there was, or ever will be. And so professing themselves to become wise, they become fools, turning the glory of the eternal God into some created thing. That is the nature. And again, I don't mean any antagonism. That is the nature of atheistic materialism. It goes a long way. Right out to the end of the universe, which they've never found or will find. It doesn't quite go far enough, because our God created what is visible and what is invisible. Amen. And the invisible God now is visible in the person of Jesus Christ. Amen. Isn't that unbelievable? I can hardly believe it. But I have to believe it. And it is revealed in the Holy Word of God. Even time, Christian theology tells us, came into being with the creation. This is how the great theologian Augustine wrote about it. And church people, philosophers, scientists have been thinking about these things forever. Augustine said, "For eternity and time are rightly distinguished by this, that time does not exist without some movement and transition, while in eternity there is no change. Who does not see that there could have been no time had not some creature been made, which by some motion could give birth to change, the very various parts of which, motion and change, as they cannot be simultaneous, succeed one another. And thus in these shorter or longer intervals of duration, time would begin. Let them therefore see that there could be no time without a creation, without a created being. And let them understand that you," and he speaks to God, "the eternal creator of all times are before all times, and that no times are co-eternal with you." God dwells in eternity, created time, is Lord of what is visible and what is invisible, both what is eternal and what is spiritual. He's creator and Lord of all these things. This is the God that we worship. This is the God who was incarnate. Now, we see that the God who created all things in this passage, by virtue of his own infinite capacity and intelligence, brought all things into being. He is called the Word. That is a very loaded, if I may say, word. The Greek word is logos. Logos has a big history philosophically, and of course now theologically. Logos has a big meaning in the Greek, even in the New Testament Greek. It means speech. It means word. It means communication. It means reason. It means account. It means explanation. It means intelligence. Our God, our intelligent God, our reasoning God, our communicating God is the one who brought all things into being. And you know what this tells me and what it has told Christians throughout the ages? It has told them that we worship a God who is in essence rational, who is discoverable, who's created a universe that is rational, discoverable, dependable, ordered, and intelligent. Every Christian scientist, and I don't mean a Christian scientist, I mean a Christian scientist, every Christian scientist who has studied the world has said, you know what? This God is intelligent. He's ordered things and created in me the ability to discover them. And that's why I trust this process of inquiry and discovery. And you know what? modern science, this atheistic materialism I'm telling you about, is built on the back and on the shoulders of Christian scientists. Christians who have explored the universe. I'll just name a few: Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, Descartes, Pascal, Newton, Bacon, Faraday, Boyle, Mendel, who discovered genetics. All Christians, many of them priests or monks or ministers or elders in their churches. We have a Pharaoh now who knows not Joseph and who takes the fruit of Joseph's work and makes claims that Joseph never would have dreamed of making. The universe is all there is or was or ever will be, but they are built on the back of Joseph, who worked under a different Pharaoh, Selah. So by virtue of his own capacity and intelligence, he brought all things into being. Isaac Newton, discoverer of gravity, who, by the way, was very interested in the book of Revelation and inspired by it, saw God as essential to the existence of space. Gravity, he said, explains the motions of the planets, but cannot explain who set the planets in motion. God governs all things and knows all that is or can be done. So we worship a God, we are told in Ephesians, who works all things after the counsel of his own will. We do not worship a God who is removed, who is unseen, uninvolved, uncaring, uncompassionate, and who is aloof. We worship of God who is actually directly, integrally, intimately involved with his creation. That is why he became incarnate. We do not worship fate. Fate is what an atheistic materialist has to worship because he doesn't have anything else to worship. What do I mean? Belief in impersonal origins, impersonal governance of the universe, fortuitous accidents. That's the faith. That is a faith. Is it not? I don't hear you. Yeah. That is a faith. That's a faith statement. We are governed by fortuitous accidents. You know what that tells me? That tells me that those who worship fate worship an impersonal God, whose operation is, and there's no who's there, actually, but just for the sake of argument, whose operation is divorced from personal choice. It is mechanical, impersonal force. No compassion, no reasoning, no actual intelligence, no intelligent design. No communicable traits. A tyrant that destroys or gives life without a thought, because there is no thought in an impersonal thing. You know what this kind of thinking does? It destroys the understanding that we are made in the image of God, and that we can understand him. We can relate to him. We can comprehend him. It's not that all of these folks are not making amazing discovering. It has been put within all mankind to discover the universe. That's who Adam was. He walked the garden in utter brilliance, discovering, naming, declaring, having insight into the nature. That's who we are, as created in the image of God. Discoveries of science are phenomenal, wonderful, marvelous. Whoever discovers them, whether it's Newton or I forget the guy's name that's writing all the books right now, it'll come back. Maybe somebody can tell me why I can't remember this. Dawkins, is his name. Richard Dawkins. All of these people can discover things because they're made in the image of God. But we're not thankful because we don't realize who it is we are and whose we are and who we worship. So we believe in a God who is intimately, integrally involved in upholding and governing the universe. We do not worship a God who is afar off. We don't even worship the God of the deists. Deists believe in God, but don't believe in the immanence of God, that he is present, that he is Emmanuel. But he has created all of the principles that we see and discover and lets the thing play out by itself. No, those things are real, but we worship a God who is integrally involved, who is close to us, who is near us. We have a compassionate, personal, active, close, near God who hears when we call upon him. He is close to us. He is with us, Emmanuel. This is how it's put in Hebrews 1, 2, and 3. If we would look at that verse. Oh, that's Hebrews 11. I'll leave that up. I'll look at that. I also want to go to Hebrews 1, 2, and 3. I want to read that first. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for. The conviction of things not seen. You see, our faith tells us there's things that we don't see, there's things we don't know, things that we have not comprehended, things that we cannot see that are only comprehended by faith. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of things visible and invisible. But what I wanted to show you was Hebrews 1, 2, and 3. If we have that one to bring up, please. In these last days, he's spoken to us by his Son. That's his message, the incarnate God. He's spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he created the world. There it is again. Through the Word, through his Son, he created the world. Through Jesus Christ. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. He upholds the universe by the word of his power. And that's what I want to focus on. He upholds the universe by the word of his power. He didn't just create it and desert it. He created it and upholds it. Intimately, integrally involved with all of this stuff that's going on. You know what's even more amazing? Integrally, intimately involved with the human race. You know what's even more amazing? Integrally, intimately involved with you. The hairs of your head are numbered. The thoughts that you think, he knows them before you speak them. When you were in the womb, he was there. And there's nowhere you can go to hide from him. And you know what? He doesn't want to hide from you. He wants to be found by you. He has come seeking you, and that's the meaning of the incarnation. Now, this God, who created all things, and by virtue of his own capacity of intelligence, created all things, has come to us in the person of Jesus Christ. He is with us, Emmanuel. This is what it says in John 1:14. We would pull that up, please. The Word, this Word that created everything, through whom all things came into being, became flesh, incarnate. Carne is the Latin for flesh. Incarnation came into flesh. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. We've seen his glory, glories of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. That's who God is, that's who Jesus Christ is, and that's what Jesus Christ has revealed us about God. He has come to us in the person of Christ. This is an amazing, mighty God. Now, he's rejected by many. He came to his own didn't receive him, we're told. But through faith in him, Christ becomes not only incarnate in the person of a baby, in the person of a man, the person Jesus Christ, he actually takes up residence within us. He makes us children of God. To everyone who believed in him, he gave the power to become a son or a daughter of God, not by the will of man, not by the will of flesh, but by the will of God. That invisible world now is invading the visible world. It's invading your own spirit. Invading is not the right word. If you will open your heart, you will welcome it in. It is not as if it is a foreign substance. It is as if you found finally the reason why you're alive. It's not an invasion. It's not an destructive force. It is life-giving. It is redemptive. It is eternal. Contact with the eternal, with the invisible world. You don't have to say, well, that's all there is. This is great, all this. But you know what Ecclesiastes said? I got news for you. If this is all you have, it's just going to go up in smoke. Every last bit of it. That's where it's all going. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. And he closes Ecclesiastes with a picture of a dying, aging, decaying, becoming more and more difficult to live in human body. And some of you know what I'm talking about. That's where it's going. Is that all there is? Man, I hope not. No. He becomes incarnate in us, and we become united with that Trinity who created all things through faith in him. And we can reject it. We can miss this. We can fail. We can fail to enter in to the free gift of God, which is eternal life through faith in Jesus. We can fail. Or we can succeed. And on some level, God energizes us and our will to make a choice to enter in. This is where the image of God meets the true and living God. We choose to enter in to that revealed gift. John 1:12, in closing, all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become the children of God. Amazing. He dwells among us. So my question is, does he dwell within each one of us? Does he dwell within you? Have you received him and been given the power to become child of God, a son or daughter? Christ's coming brings us into intimate relationship with the creator of the universe. That's what we are celebrating at Christmas. Emmanuel, he dwells among us.